Welcome to another Baseball America Prospect Handbook podcast. J.J. Cooper, Matt Eddy joining you today. Got two things really to cover today. First off, we're going to wrap up the Rule 5. Matt and I are both there for the always amazing Rule 5. I think it took, 11 minutes this year? Something like that. And when we're done with the Rule 5, we're going to move on. We have to do our National League West Prospects Draft. We've gotten a lot of good feedback from people that they seem to be enjoying this kind of format. If you haven't listened to the first couple, they're available on the site. But what we do is we take a look at each of the NL West top 10s. We lop off the number one prospects, and then we draft back and forth to see which guys we would rather have, looking at all five of the organizations together. So we're going to do that in just a second. Do want to remind you that the Baseball America books are all available. You can go to baseballamerica.com/store. And check out all the books. We got the Almanac arriving very shortly. We have the calendar. The Great Parks calendar is out. We're finishing up very shortly the Prospect Handbook. That'll be out, obviously not by Christmas, but we're within range where you can see it being shipped before too long. And then we also have the Super Register, and we have the Baseball America Directory coming out a little later in the winter. So those are coming up. You can check them out again at baseballamerica.com/store. But we now move on to the Rule 5 draft. Well, what we wanted to do is just give you a little thumbnail. Only 9 guys taken in the Major League portion, so we don't have to dive in too deeply. We're not covering all 38 players taken in the minor league portion of this. Sorry, Rule 5 geeks. But that should still be enough to give us a good feel. With that in mind, I'm going to basically start off with Matt's going to give you kind of a stat that stood out for each of the 9 guys who was taken. Once he does that, then I'm going to give some little scouting background on what I found when we were doing the scouting reports on these guys leading into the draft in many cases. So starting off, number one, Patrick Schuster.
Schuster traded to the Padres. Mm-hmm. The thing that stands out about him, he's got the low arm angle, but he's also got pretty good control and pretty good dominating results against left-handed batters. He had a 5-1 strikeout to walk against lefties. Striking out about 3 out of every 10. And he's got that tough angle, and it's the angle more so than the pure stuff that the Padres were interested in.
It was worth it. We had a pretty good sense, even the night before, that the Padres were going to draft a left-handed reliever. And the interesting part of that was that we knew that, and we thought like 4 or 5 really good, solid candidates. And no. And we, okay, 5 more, and we never came up with Patrick Schuster. I mean, we threw it out at the very end, kind of like, okay, maybe, but it wasn't something where we were in any way confident they were taking Patrick Schuster. And I think a lot of that is that he's a little further away. There were some guys, there were some lefty on lefty, and this is what Schuster is really probably going to be a lefty on lefty reliever.
Yep.
There were guys who are a little closer to the big leagues who are, who probably are equally effective against lefties as we saw it.
Mm-hmm.
The thing that Schuster, you probably do remember if you've read Baseball America at all, is that Schuster had an amazing no-hitter streak in high school. He's always had some feel for pitch. And if you matched him up with the other left-on-left lefty who went in this Rule 5 draft, who we'll get to in a minute, Brian Moran, he may be a little bit better long-term against right-handers than Moran. A little bit more stuff, I would argue.
His results in 2013, for sure, were a lot better against right-handers.
So that's number one. That moves us on to number two.
Adrian Nieto, the catcher the White Sox drafted.
First catcher drafted since 2008 in Rule 5.
Yeah. What really stood out to me, I didn't know this going in, is he actually finished 5th in the Carolina League with a .373 on base percentage. That's far removed from the major leagues, but you have a young switch-hitting catcher. Shows some field to hit, some field to draw walks, get on base. You let him sit out a year and let him get some more development. You might have something.
And it'll be interesting to see what the White Sox do with this, because the normal argument for never taking a catcher in the Rule 5 is that you don't take a catcher in the Rule 5 unless he's ready to be your primary backup catcher, because you generally only carry 2. I don't know if Nieto's ready to be that primary. I don't know if he's ready for 200, 250 at-bats this year.
Right.
That being said, the White Sox catching situation is pretty poor. Maybe they're willing to carry him as a third catcher for, at least part of the year, kind of ease him into that role. and knowing, okay, there may be a payoff down the road for it. That was why I was a little surprised when I saw that that even we kind of got it hammered out beforehand that Nieto was probably going to the White Sox. Carlos Perez to me is a guy, Astros catcher, who's much more ready to be. If you said the White Sox took Carlos Perez, I would have said, okay, I think he has a very solid chance to be their backup catcher this year. You know, and whether that means Flowers or Fegley, one of those guys was going to be not up, down Triple A or whatever. I don't know if Nieto, I feel, is confident about that. That being said, as you just touched on, Nieto has more offensive upside. Even if I did talk to a number of scouts who still had him pegged more as kind of a fringe big leaguer down the road, and were a little surprised to see him get taken in the Rule 5 draft.
Yeah, no, I mean, the last 2 years he has a .450 slugging. Versus right-handers.
He's got a little bit better bat than the average catcher who's available in the Rule 5. Then the question is, defensively okay, not outstanding yet.
Right, boxes
some balls every now and then, and he's yet to play above the ball. That's going to be a big jump.
Well, the White Sox do have some flexibility. Fegley has options. Flowers is probably out of options, but they might. If Nieto looks good, they might expose him to waivers.
So, okay. On to number three.
Kevin Munson, the right-handed reliever taken by the Phillies. Thing to watch here, he has good stuff, but he allowed quite a bit of power to right-handed batters, which is supposed to be his good split. So he allowed 5 home runs last year, 349 slugging, which is actually pretty high for a one-inning reliever. That's the thing I would watch with him, but he does have good stuff.
Good stuff. I think after the draft I did tweet out, Munson to me is the second most likely to stick. Mm-hmm. And I say that because it's not as big a jump for him. He's a little closer to the big league. Some of these other guys we're talking about, way closer to the big league than one of the guys we'll be talking about in just a minute. And again, solid stuff with a little bit. I mean, it's not something where he's all over the place. It's not something where he never throws a strike, anything like that. So he was a guy who you heard a lot of mentions of coming into the draft, that he was a guy who could get picked. Mm-hmm. There were some guys who didn't get picked who I thought would also have been good fits. But he'll be a guy, I think, who has a decent chance to.
Low leverage roster. Reliever.
Yeah.
The fourth pick was Tommy Conley,
mm-hmm.
by the Rockies from the Yankees. He's striking out more than a quarter of batters on both sides, but he's also walking 17%. So that works out to roughly, one out of every 5 batters. That's a very high ratio for a.
That's worrisome.
It's very scary. But they love the arm strength.
Right. He's a stash guy. And really the question becomes, are you going to be able to stash him? Because he's a stash guy unless his control takes a big step forward. Control is less of a concern for a reliever than it is for a starter. That being said, he's been a reliever. The idea is that you bear down in one inning, the control is a little less of a problem because you just air it out for one inning. That's not been the case for Conley up to now. I was kind of interested to see he went Danny Barawa, another Yankees arm with a very similar profile, did not go. So it'll be interesting to see, kind of compare Conley and Barawa this year. Like, did they get the right one?
It'll be the great what-if question of our time.
Yes, I know. People will write books about that, as it goes along. So on to number 5.
Okay, the fifth pick, Brian Moran, the left-handed reliever who's now with the Angels. The number that jumps out here is 38% strikeout rate against AAA left-handed batters the last 2 years. That's extremely good. If he can maintain that, he will be a valuable piece of the bullpen.
The interesting part about this is one of the things that's definitely come out in the Rule 5, it's very much, we have Rangers Director of Pro Scouting, Josh Boyd, made the point yesterday, Rule 5 is very much eye of the beholder. Yeah. We're talking after the draft. If you like a guy, you take him, even if, because your team has good reports on him, and it may not be a consensus pick across the industry or anything like that. That being said, teams who pick later and want to contend, the guys that they want to take, almost without fail, they end up trading up. The Rangers have only taken, the Rangers did not take a pick player in the Major League portion this year, but the Rangers, who have generally been contending, have had a number of Rule 5 picks over the years.
Yep.
They're almost never. They've only drafted one Rule 5 pick with their pick, Major League portion, in the last, I think, 10 years.
Cody Woods.
Right, Cody Woods. Yeah. Everyone else is a guy who they had to essentially trade up to get. That's what you saw here, even here with the Angels, who were picking, I think, 14. They felt like they had to trade up if they were going to get a guy who, mm-hmm. who makes a whole lot of sense for them, mm-hmm. because He's a left. Brian Moran's a left on left reliever. 84, 88, funky, more of arm angle deception, coming, hard for lefties to pick him up. You don't want him to face a right-handed hitter.
They traded Scott Downs this year.
Ever, yeah. I mean, exactly. They think they're trying to contend. That's where he's going to fit in. Is just like a cheap addition to the pen.
Yep. Okay.
On to number six.
Number six was Seth Rosin. Now he's with the Dodgers, but he's drafted from the Phillies. He was fifth in the Eastern League in WHIP, 1.22 as a starter. He doesn't really have a split that really jumps out. 3-1 strikeout to walk against right-handed batters. Good 2.37 average allowed to right-handed batters. He's more of your generic. I would say the number for him would be 45, as in the grades for his three pitches.
I'd be honest. That's one I don't see him sticking. I don't think he's going to do anything. He's a solid pitcher, but I don't think he's going to do anything well enough that when it's all said and done, when you, the restrictions that you carry, especially if a guy, the one thing you got to remember of putting a Rule 5 guy, I'm not telling you, you know this, but you put a Rule 5 guy in the bullpen. One of the things you like with your bullpen, you like those guys who have options. You like when your bullpen's really taxed and you've used them a lot this week. Okay, we're sending you down for 2 weeks, basically to rest and recover. But more than that, we need to bring another arm up just to keep our, so we have some guys to turn to tonight. You had a Rule 5 guy, you don't have that flexibility. I don't think he's necessarily, nothing against him, I don't know if he's going to bring enough to make up for that.
I will mention, though, what was it, 2010? Mm-hmm. The Dodgers carried Carlos Monasterios, also drafted from the Phillies organization, which is kind of a strange parallel. I'm not saying they're the same pitcher, but it's
it did happen.
Unique. Okay.
Now, here's the most interesting pick of the Rule 5 draft. That'll be Russell Wilson, who we will not really cover on this podcast. But the most interesting pick to me of the Major League portion at the seventh pick of the Rule 5.
Yeah, a 21-year-old Taiwanese right-hander, Wei Chung Wang, had Tommy John surgery in his past, has had a voided and renegotiated contract.
Which made him eligible.
With the Pirates. Now he's with the Brewers. He had a 10.5 strikeout to walk ratio last year in the Gulf Coast.
Right,
so
that's good numbers. You like 10.5. That's good.
So if you wanted to count like the traveling rookie leagues and short season, he's six levels below the major leagues.
Yeah, he's, to put it this way, he's yet to have a professional baseball trip where they stayed somewhere overnight.
That's right.
And now he's going to be potentially in the big leagues. That would be. Correct me if I'm wrong, but you are kind of a Rule 5 aficionado. I'm not going to say ever, because with the Rule 5, it goes back a long, long way. In the modern Rule 5 era, I mean, no one's ever been drafted out of the DSL. This would be the biggest jump. If he did stick, it's hard to have a bigger jump than going from the lowest complex league to the big leagues.
I would mention the two extreme outliers, Josh Hamilton.
Mm-hmm.
Had like a couple weeks in the New York Penn League.
Right. But had played a full season in high A before this.
But I think the better parallel is Joaquin Soria, who had much more experience in the Mexican and Mexican Pacific League.
Right.
I believe he had 12 innings in the U.S. minors.
Right.
It was mostly in the DSL and the various Mexican leagues.
Right.
And that would be your best case scenario.
That being said, that was the difference of, I come back to it. It's not that like he won't be able to handle it, but the GCL, you get on a bus, you go to a game, you come back. I mean, I don't even think there's no facilities to shower a lot of times. You just ride back on your bus because you're not going very far anyway. And you go from that to, oh, here's someone who takes your bags and puts them, and all that. It'd be probably the best stuff of anyone taken in the draft, although I would argue that maybe the number eight pick we're coming up to may be a little better stuff. But, it's all upside. Is it probably going to work out? No. Is it okay that if it doesn't, and it was a $25,000 gamble? Sure, I have no problem with that pick. It's just unlikely to work out. But hey, if it's a 5% shot, it's going to work out. If it's a 5% shot that he turns into a productive big leaguer for them, and in the, it's $6 million, $7 million a win, on the free agent market now, if he could turn into a, even a one-win player down the road, a year, you'd be talking about at $25,000 risk, that's pocket change.
Yeah, there's always kind of the option as well that teams could trade for these players, and keep them with no restriction. So that's always that might be in the back of the mind for some of these teams too.
Exactly.
Particularly with the player.
Once you have them, it's a lot more easy to say, "Hey, can we work something out to keep this guy?" Than it is just you're not gonna. It's not easy. If you called up and said, "Hey, we saw him in the GCL and we really want him, and you want him to kind of be a cornerstone of a trade," I think generally the recipient team is going to hear that call and go, "Do they know something we don't?" Because you don't get calls to say, "Hey, we have a trade. Our main target is going to be this guy's in the GCL for you." Those are throw-ins to trades, not guys you pick up as main parts.
Yep, but we see about maybe two of those trades a year where teams trade to retain their Rule 5s. Number 8 was Marcus Bateo, the Dominican right-handed reliever, JJ's boy. 488 OPS against right-handed batters this year between AA, AAA, and the Dominican League. He can really shut down right-handed batters.
Which, if you said, give me something that's valuable in a reliever, I'll take that. the big thing being with him is that it's with very legit stuff. In the Dominican League this winter, he's throwing 95-plus. I mean, and by plus, I'm probably selling him short. He's throwing strikes. He's not walking anybody. He's throwing a slider that's anywhere from 86 to, I've heard, 90. He has big league time in the past. I think when this Rule 5 draft's over, I know he's the 8th guy taken. There's a chance that he's had elbow problems. There's obviously a chance that he could get hurt and we just never hear from him again. But he's my pick to be the guy who's most likely that we look back in this Rule 5 draft from this year and go, "Wow, that was a good pickup." And again, by good pickup in the Rule 5 draft, that probably means he was a useful 7th inning guy for a couple of years. That's the bar that you're trying to clear here.
Yeah, and he's going to a team that clearly wants to win now in the Diamondbacks.
And I think he could help them.
Mm-hmm. 9th and final pick, Michael Almanzar, a third baseman out of the Red Sox system. The thing about him that really stands out is he's got good power against left-handers. 477 slugging in the Eastern League this year, 13% strikeout rate. He's got very good bat-to-ball skills on the weak side of the split equation, and he's got some pop.
And played third, played first, so he does. You could see him potentially fitting as a backup corner and play a little, you know, again, okay, lefties on the mound, maybe you even DH him every now and then, like, okay, or it's the American League, so you don't see a whole lot of, of pinch hitting or anything. But just one thing that struck me when he's taken is like, he's in the same, Colbrin Vidic, who was the Red Sox first round pick a few years ago, third baseman also available. And understandably, I mean, I don't think anyone was sniffing there, you know, that. But another third baseman for the Red Sox goes instead. I think if you're the Red Sox, and this is nothing as Almanzar, but you don't like to lose talent. But if you said, okay, pick a position where the Red Sox could lose someone and be okay, third base is probably a pretty good one when you have Middlebrooks, Bogarts, who can play there if they ended up re-signing Steven Drew, and Garen Cecchini. So Almanzar, it's a much better situation, I think, for him in Baltimore. Don't know it'll stick, but the Orioles have had pretty good success, even while contending.
Yeah,
last 2 years, while they've been basically in the playoff race, they've had Rule 5 pick stick.
Yep, both years.
Well, that's our Rule 5.
There you go.
Yay! Okay, you know, enjoy, Rule 5 fans. You know I'm one of you. When I say Rule 5 geeks, I say that and I mean that with love, because I was hashtagging Rule 5 fever all week, tracking down Rule 5 rumors, which is a very solitary pursuit in many ways. But that leads us on to our draft. I got to draft first when we did our NL Central.
You did. You won.
I mean, you
won that first pick alone.
That means that it switches back, and so Matt gets the first pick. As we've mentioned on all these, do remember, number one picks are not available for this, so number one prospects. So it's not that we don't think that Archie Bradley's really good, because he would go. Jonathan Gray would go very quickly. Jock Peterson would go very quickly. Austin Hedges would go very quickly. And I think Kyle Crick would go very quickly. I don't know. Before we start, I will throw out, okay, I feel confident that Bradley, Gray, maybe Peterson, and maybe Crick would go before any of the twos. I don't know. I don't think Crick would go before all the twos. I'm pretty confident on that. But what would you say? I mean, like,
Yeah, I would draw the line probably after Gray, actually. I could see a case for taking a number two over Peterson, Hedges, or Crick.
Okay, but it's like it's in that line, and they would all be going very quickly, I think.
Yeah, yeah.
Even I think Crick is...
They're all legit number ones.
Right, they're all legit number ones. Crick is number five of that group to me, but I still think that he would go pretty quickly if he were adding them to the exercise. That being said, they're not available. You get the first pick. I think I know which way you're going, and I'm kind of bummed about it.
I'm not going to take your cheese ball, but I'm going to take Eddie Butler, Rocky's right-hander.
I'm kind of bummed about it because, yes, I mean, he's the clear number one pick in this draft, I think.
Yeah, I debated it a little bit, but I think the stuff is too electric that you have to, you know, you're looking at potential pluses for three pitch types.
The best way to put it is Jonathan Gray is a stud prospect. And there was a very legit debate in our offices, Jonathan Gray versus Eddie Butler. Mm-hmm. And I think you could have made an argument. I mean, you could make an argument. Butler's closer to the big leagues, and his stuff, it's not Jonathan Gray stuff, because you're talking triple digits, and Jonathan Gray does it from 6'4", 250 versus a much smaller framed Eddie Butler. That being said, if you told me Butler, you said I can only have Eddie Butler and you can have Jonathan Gray, I'm not all that bummed about that. That's not a very... They're not that far apart.
That is the concern. It's not like a prototype workhorse starter frame.
Right.
He's more like a Clay Buchholz type frame.
Right.
So, but the stuff is undeniable. He's been healthy so far. I'm taking him.
That being said, yeah, it's now I'm going to go a little bit off the board for my number two pick.
I think I know where you're going.
I think you know exactly where I'm going. So here we go to Julio Urias, which is the number three prospect in the Dodgers organization. Behind Corey Seager, who I'm sure we'll see his name pop up here before too long. I'm going to go with the 16-year-old with stuff with, when I say amazing feel, it doesn't do it justice. We would never get to see this in an American high school pitcher. You know, you don't get to find out what a very polished American high school pitcher, 16-year-old, could do if he got to pitch in the Midwest League. And why is that? Because they're not eligible to do it. I mean, I guess unless you go way, way, way back to the to the 40s, and when pretty much during World War II, anyone and everyone was available.
Two arms not required.
Joe Nuxall, you know, being the prime example. I had scouts tell me this year, look, I know he's I know he's 16, and I know 16-year-old Midwest League is shocking. He could pitch in Double A right now. Like, scouts who were convicted, they had no doubt that he could pitch in Double A and succeed as a 16-year-old. He's going to pitch in High A. I mean, I don't think there's any reason. They kept his innings limited, but 2-0, 2.48, and 18 starts with 44 hits allowed in 54 innings, more than 67 Ks in 54 innings. He's going to High A next year. And he may make it to Double A next year as a 17-year-old, which is insane.
Yeah, when's the last 19-year-old pitcher we've seen in the major leagues?
Felix?
Probably.
He's not Felix from the standpoint of
Scott Kazmir?
I thought it was 20 for him.
Yeah.
But it wasn't far.
It's rare.
It's rare. For him, if it's 19 when he hits the big leagues, he's going to have slowed down his ascent. Because, again, even if you said a level a year...
Right.
Okay, so he spends this year in High A, and I think he'll pitch in Double A this year. But let's say a level year, so this year is spent primarily as a 17-year-old. He'll turn 18 in the final 3 weeks of the season. Then you go to, you know, so then you say Double A as an 18-year-old. Be honest with that, if he has three full seasons, Low A, High A, Double A, it's unlikely he doesn't get a call up at the end of that year if he's pitching, if they're in the playoff, you know, contending and all, because he can help them. I think he'll be in the big leagues as an 18-year-old.
Wow,
might be 19. Right, I'll take this.
I'll bet board that with you.
I might be 19 because it might be 19 again if the progression. I'm not gonna bet board yet because I'm saying if the progression goes like, I mean, because you know, I wouldn't take that bet from the standpoint of we never know when TJ. You know, there's all kind of things that can happen if he, I mean, takes a you know, breaks his hand at a comebacker or something. You know, anything could screw that up because that involves him not getting hurt. But it is amazing just how kind of the progression goes for him.
Mm-hmm.
So, sorry, I've talked too much about Julio Urias. On back to you.
I am going with perhaps the most unheralded right-hander in the minors, Matt Whistler, Padres number two.
He would have been my next pick, too. So.
I think you're looking at to minimum 60 pitches with a fastball and slider. It's potentially a 7 fastball. You don't get the third pitch quite the caliber of Butler, but I think the he's got exceptional control and power stuff. I like him quite a bit, and a good pitcher's build too. It's projectable still.
I think I may have gone that way myself, so I like that pick. I'm going to go Corey Seager. I guess I'm staying with the Dodgers. I would have probably, again, these are BA rankings, not any one of our personal rankings. We kind of work them all together. Personally, I'd have Urias 2, Seager 3. I think, I say that even just as I've talked to more and more people post, I did the Midwest League list. I think I had Seager ahead of Urias on that one. So I may even be having inconsistency with myself. But at this moment as I draft him, I don't think there's that much separation between the two of them. The good things with Seager is that it's a pretty premium bat, potentially, left-handed bat. Mm-hmm. From a guy who, left-handed bat at positions that it's valuable at, he's gonna play somewhere in the infield, I think. I don't think it's going to be shortstop, probably going to be a third baseman. But a left-handed hitting third baseman with some power, with some field to hit. The knocks on him are you do get some inconsistent effort, it feels like sometimes. Sometimes guys, scouts who saw him in the Midwest League, saw him in especially in the Arizona Fall League, felt like he did not look like he wanted to be there. It was the end of a very long season for him, so you don't want to write him off too much for that. Mm-hmm. At the same time, scouts always want to see guys who basically, it's game 155, and they're like, yeah, I'm here.
Just always remember Mike Trout hit, 180 right. or whatever. No, exactly. NFL.
Byron Buxton hit 210 this year, and I'll take Byron Buxton over any other prospect in the game by far. No, I don't know about that, but by far. So that's the way I'm going. Back to you.
I'm not going to do much to help my risk profile here, but I'm taking another pitcher. Max Fried, Padres left-hander. Padres 6'4 left-hander. If you think about where Tyler Skaggs was, when he was 18, think about maybe a half grade to a full grade better. You're looking at a big curveball, a big body left-hander who still has a little room to fill out and add velo and improve his control, which is all stuff he has to do.
But I agree with you. I think if you compare every step along the way, when they were in high school, mm-hmm. Skaggs has always had solid stuff, and his stuff ticked up a tick and then maybe ticked back a tick this year. But mm-hmm. that being said, you look at the two, and Freed's always had a little bit more stuff. So, no, I was leaning that way maybe too. We're consensus right now.
I know, it's scary. I wanted to try to get a position player here, but these pitchers are all good at this point.
Hey, I've got Seager already on my team. So that leads it back to me. I'm gonna go to our pitcher. I'll go Braden Shipley. I want Eddie Butler more than either of my pitchers, but Shipley, I think, could move pretty quickly. Advanced field probably should be able to stay as a starter. I think he'd be a fine reliever if he didn't, but I think he probably should. I would expect that he pitches a good bit in Double A this year at some point. I know he's kind of ticketed probably for High A, but I think he's advanced enough that you'll see him make the jump at some point in 2014, barring all the standard things that we talk about. But, he's a little bit lower risk than maybe like a guy like Max Fried. Mm-hmm. I don't think he has the upside, but I think he is a little closer, a little less to work on.
Yep. One of the top college pitchers available in this draft.
Oh, yeah.
So, okay. I'm going to take a position player. I'm looking at two shortstops here. I'm going to take the Diamondbacks, Chris Owens.
Good. I'll take the other one.
Yeah, Chris Owings. I think, because the other one, I have serious questions I want to see answered. I think Chris Owings has his warts, but
he's going to play in the big leagues, and he's going to do it before long.
But, yeah, you're looking at a potential first-division second baseman, in the context of the Diamondbacks, unless they trade him,
Unless they trade Didi Gregorius, which there are rumors about, too.
Owings could probably be a 5 major league shortstop. Nothing flashy. But I think the bat-to-ball skills are good. Got good gap power, can run a little bit.
I'll ask you this. Compare him to a guy you're pretty well familiar with who's now in the big leagues, but compare him to Nick Franklin. Who do you like better?
Probably Franklin, I think.
Why do you like Franklin better than him?
More power. He's a good left-handed hitter. Can't hit right-handed at all. But I think if you're looking for a guy who's neither one of us is going to be a star, but I think Franklin has louder raw tools.
I might go Owings. And partly because I do think that Owings has a better shot. Like, with Franklin, And they don't have to trade Franklin, but now that they've, you know, acquired Cano, mm-hmm. there's a lot of talk that they will trade Franklin. Mm-hmm. If you want Franklin to be, you know, and if you don't worry about his career and what you're doing to that, you could make him a useful utility infielder on that team because he can play short. But I don't think you'd ever consider starting. I don't think he could be a five shortstop.
They have left-handed hitters at second and third. That's a really big hindrance for Nick Franklin.
No, it is.
And if Brad Miller, they could have left-handed hitters all over the infield.
That is crazy.
So Franklin would be the least useful piece for that.
Whereas for another team, he would probably be pretty useful.
Yeah, he'd be the best thing ever.
But that, you know, and really he has more value. You would really want to do that from the standpoint of, I do think there are teams out there who it would be useful for them to have Nick Franklin, you know. Mm-hmm. If I might be calling the Yankees, and you know, I don't know what you'd want from the Yankees, but hey, we just took your second baseman.
I want Barawa and Conley.
Sorry, we can't give you Conley now. We lost him. But I do think Owings, at the same time, I think Franklin can play shortstop as a backup. I think Owings can play as a starter. He's not going to do it. He's not going to push Didi Gregorius aside because Didi Gregorius is better defensively. But
he's a one in strat.
Right, but I do think that Owings can play it. You know, where if they did trade Didi Gregorius, he would be their shortstop. I'll put it that way.
Yeah, I don't want to talk down Owings. He's my fourth-round pick here. I choose to believe that the improvements in his walk-to-strikeout ratio in the second half at AAA are for real. So
I'll go with the riskier. There have been a whole lot of Asheville creations over the years. I'm trying to think. You may remember such hits as Joe Koshansky and...
Jordan Pacheco was awesome there.
Jordan Pacheco, and I think right now you have to go Trevor Story, like, needs to prove that he wasn't one of those.
Kyle Parker's been pretty good, you know,
but
all the way up.
But Rosel Herrera in his return to Nashville, let's make that clear also, 343, 419, 515. He has some power now. I think he's gonna have a good bit more power. I think without a doubt, because he's got the frame to do that. Mm-hmm. There is legit questions about whether he's going to be a shortstop long term. Mm-hmm. I'm not that worried about that as far as adding him to my fictional team that's never going to play a game and all that. But I'm not that worried about that from the standpoint of if he's not going to be a shortstop, he's going to play somewhere where defense, you know, he's still going to be at a premium position. He might be a second baseman, he might be a third baseman, he might be a center fielder. It's going to be one of those. And I just do like, I mean, it's a good body, it's a good feel to hit, there's a lot of tools there, and he's put them together somewhat.
Mm-hmm. It's a good left-handed swing, too. He's a switch hitter, better from the left side.
Yeah. Back to you.
Yikes. How far are we taking this? There's no Brewers this time.
We haven't taken a Giant yet, so we're at least going until, you know. And I think a Giant, but it's going to be a little quicker here, because I think there is a Giant in the mix before too long.
Yeah.
Our choice is now to give an example of the next guy available. If you go by rankings, we have Matt Davidson, third base for the Diamondbacks. We have Kyle Parker, who you've already mentioned, first baseman outfielder for the Rockies. Zach Lee for the Dodgers. Hunter Renfro for the Padres list, which you did, and Edwin Escobar for the Giants. Now, again, by the rules of this, if you want to take number 10 Giants prospect Clayton Blackburn, you can. I don't think you will. But you're not limited to those. But just to give our podcast listeners, as they're hanging on the edge of their seats, wondering which way you're going to go.
I'm going to take Zach Lee, Dodgers number 4 prospect. They're
safe pick.
The right-hander. Yeah, he is.
Matt likes his security.
He's a number 4 profile, you know. It's really his pitchability and command that makes the stuff play up. I don't think there's a 60 pitch there. Slider might be close. But he's a guy who pitches off his fastball and just knows how to use his stuff. That's my guy.
I'm going to go, and I think you can sense that there's a little bit more like, oh, okay, these lists thinned out pretty quickly here. Mm-hmm. I'm going to go with one of your guys from the Padres list. Evaluations, I think, are coming up here before long at Baseball America. So in true Aaron Fitt fashion, I will I'll pick Hunter Renfro, thereby currying favor with our boss, John Manuel, because no one's a bigger Hunter Renfro believer than John Manuel.
No.
And John's got good feel, so I'm kind of taking it on faith in John's feel, because John really believes in Hunter Renfro. So, back to you.
There you go. with my 6th pick, I'm taking my 2nd position player, Diamondbacks 3rd baseman, Matt Davidson. Good power stroke to right center field, all the way to left, his pull side. you know, when all said and done, he's probably not much more than a 50 or a fringe defender, maybe more of a second division starter type of guy, but I like the power in his bat, and at this point in the draft, he's my guy.
Okay. Comes back to me. I'm going to go for a risky, safe pick. I'm going to go Casey Kelly, who's risky because we don't know for sure that, you know, that he made it all the way back from his Tommy John. But if he did, he very well could be, you know, ready for to help out in the big leagues in 2014. So I'll go that over Edwin Escobar. Sorry, Edwin and Giants beat. But that is, to me, he's a risky, safe pick.
Yeah, I like Kelly.
You've always been a kind of a Casey Kelly believer.
Yeah, the things that he's good at, he's really good at, and he started missing bats in 2012.
And you know, you don't want to overplay the two-sport thing, but he's, when you say a pitcher who has athleticism, a pitcher who played pro ball as a shortstop while pitching and was a legitimate football prospect as well, that there's some true athleticism there. Not just, oh, he played a sport at some point. Because Adam Dunn played football, but I don't think athleticism is really what I think of Adam Dunn.
This is tough here. This is pick seven.
Pick seven.
We've got the Rockies first baseman Kyle Parker. We've got Dodgers right-hander Chris Anderson.
You skipped Aaron Blair with the Diamondbacks.
Aaron Blair with the Diamondbacks. You took Kelly, so that we're up to Reimer Liriano for the Padres. You know, I might go with Edwin Escobar here. Take the, Venezuelan left-hander, 6'1", 2-plus pitches. It's kind of a footnote to history being he was traded for a Rule 5 pick. We talked about the Rule 5 retention trades in the past. The Giants got him when they drafted Ben Snyder for the Rangers and traded him for Edwin Escobar. So he's actually a Rangers signee.
Mm-hmm.
So knowing their track record on the international market makes me want Edwin Escobar even more.
And really the question of him is going to be, he projects pretty well. Is it going to be end up being as a power reliever, or is it going to be more of a, you know, middle rotation starter? That's kind of still to be determined. We'll see. And that's probably why both of us were kind of, we're so holding off on taking him. It's just that if you're taking the guy who's still a little bit on the fringe between which way he's going to go versus the guys who, like comparing Casey Kelly to him, Casey Kelly's going to start.
Mm-hmm.
Again, unless the velo disappeared with the elbow injury.
Unless he turned into Chris Volstad, right?
Right, he's going to start. And so with that being the case, we're generally going to take the starter over the
I'm talking myself into Escobar here. I like him.
Which means I got to take one more pick and we're done.
Yeah.
No, I'm not going Chris Stratton. No. I'm not going Reimer Liriano. Chris Anderson is possible. Alexander Guerrero, like the top, I'm not going to do, but you know, David Dahl would be an interesting, you know what I am? I'm going David Dahl. I'm going all upside. If we were doing this draft a year ago, David Dahl would not have been, well, now he would be, if Jonathan Gray in this parallel universe was in the Rockies organization, Jonathan Gray would have been ranked ahead of him, so would Eddie Butler. But if the David Dahl of a year ago was transplanted with a time machine to right now, he would have gone well before this.
Mm-hmm.
When you say terrible 2013 season, not as much statistically just as a completely lost season. Sent back from, I don't know if he got unpacked in Asheville before they sent him back to, in kind of a disciplinary measure for what, he was late for a flight.
He booked his own flight to Asheville or some, that was the company line.
There was something like that where it was like, okay, and to show that, you know, hey, even our star prospects have to follow the rules, they sent him back to the complex, eventually let him come back out, and
I believe he got hurt running to first base. He strained some sort of leg muscle or something.
Yeah, hamstring, I think it was, and then it was done.
Severely tore his right hamstring.
Right, and it was done.
We publish this stuff, don't we?
Yes. You know, I knew this stuff. You're acting like it's skeptical. No, these things did happen. But, you know, and so take all that with it. At the same time, this was a guy who was a premium prospect coming into the year. Yes, you would rather that he had gone to Asheville and hit 300 with a 400 on base and a 500 slugging, and he would be, I'll put this way, he's probably not going to make the top 100 this year because it was a completely lost year of development. He will go into next year a year behind where he was coming into this year. All that being said, He has some premium tools. He had the year he had a year ago was outstanding. Mm-hmm. And there is something often that works out pretty well for a guy who kind of deals with that adversity and realizes after the games come relatively easy to him, whoa, you know, there's a lot that I have to do to get to where I want to go. It can often be useful in that way. Mm-hmm. So I'll take David Dahl to wrap up this exercise.
All right.
So we'll move on to the AL East before long, which you know what's going to be interesting at that one? I think our rule will be, you know, it's going to be interesting to see how many Red Sox are taken before the first Yankee. Because let's be honest, there's a lot of our listeners who that's what they'll be interested to hear, Yankees and Red Sox fans alike. So, but just to kind of recap, we took three Diamondbacks.
Let me do it again.
We took two Rockies. No, three Rockies. Three Rockies. We skipped. I skipped Cal Parker and Chad Bettis and went down to David Dahl, took the wild card. We took three Dodgers. We took four Padres. And we took a Giant. So, a relatively even distribution. I guess before we wrap this up, I will say, if you had one of these farm systems, which one would you take?
Do we probably both agree that you think you say Bradley's probably the best prospect in this division? Or would you go with Gray or Butler?
I'll put it this way. They're in the same group enough that, I put them in the same box. All three of those really are among the best starting pitching prospects.
You know, wouldn't it surprise me? I mean, the Rockies probably have the highest ceilings. When you figure Gray might have a one profile, Butler a two, Herrera might be a starter on the infield, Dahl might be a starter in center field, Tom Murphy might be a power-hitting catcher.
That's the one I
want. They've got some upside, yeah.
That's the one I want.
Ramil Tapia is far away, but he's an interesting center fielder at this stage. He's kind of like the David Dahl of this year.
To me, that's the farm system I want of these. I just look at it again, and I know you're right. I mean, there's more. You talk about there's more risk when you talk about pitchers than you talk about hitters. At the same time, and we get this every year when we do a top 100. I respect Dave Cameron's stuff and all, and I really like Dave Cameron's stuff, but Dave Cameron always says, they're overvaluing pitchers when they do their top 100. They're overvaluing pitchers. We're not doing it from the standpoint of trying to line it up as far as, as I view it at least, we're not saying here is the perfect distribution of WAR where our goal is that when it's all said and done, the number one, it'd be great if that happened, but if Jonathan Gray is riskier, yes, he's riskier than a position player prospect because he's a pitcher. Pitchers have much more ways that they can get hurt in ways that adversely affect his career. A hitter, there's really not a whole lot of hitting injuries you could have that pretty much mean, you could be done. There are a lot of those in pitching. That being said, Jonathan Gray, when I put the top 100 together, it's like a combination of prospect status, which guys I think are going to turn into stars, and also throw into that a little bit of, and what's their trade value? Like if you said, I think that the number five guy on the list should, if the number five guy is on that list is offered for the number 25 guy on the list, that the team that has the 25 guy be like, in a moment we'll do that. Jonathan Gray, yes, he's riskier. If the Rockies called up and they wanted to use, they can't use him yet because he's only been drafted a year ago, they want to use Eddie Butler, who could be drafted. And they said, we want to trade Eddie Butler. Eddie Butler has a pretty massive amount of trade value as a prospect right now. Mm-hmm. Compared to a safer, there's not really a great first base prospect in the game right now, but if there was, a solid first base prospect is way safer than a very good pitching prospect. But the very good pitching prospect has more trade value, I'd argue, every time.
Yeah, because his skills are just more rare. It's just harder to find a pitcher
right.
who can throw mid-90s, has a great build, and has potential 2-plus secondary pitches.
Again, Max Fried, there's a whole lot of risk there about whether Max Fried's ever going to be a useful big league starter.
Good luck finding someone else who has the same basic tools to work with.
And that's what teams know. The reality of it is right now we see it in the free agent market right now. If you need a position player, we see it with first baseman right now. Okay, the Brewers are watching all the first base. The Mariners are collecting all the first basemen and putting them over in the corner and taking them away.
Trade value. It's a trade value proposition.
But the Brewers aren't really panicking. We got to pay James Loney whatever we can. We have to get them because they always feel like you can always put together something at first base. We saw a terrible example of it with what the Brewers tried to do last year after their injuries. But you can always do that. Whereas teams go out there and they're willing to spend four years and what, $7, $8, $9 million depending on the player, for middle to back end of the rotation starters, because the reality is that there's not that same confidence that you can just sign some minor league, you know, some guys with invites to spring minor league contracts within that spring training and find a starter out of there. Not that it doesn't happen, but pitching is at least as I see it, you said, it's just rare to find guys who especially could pitch in the front end of rotations. Mm-hmm. But, well, that's another division draft in the books. Three of them down, three to go. Between the time we do the next one, we have a lot of, in my case, prospect handbook writing. In your case, a lot of prospect handbook editing ahead of us before we do the next one. It won't be probably the, I guess it might be the, no, we'll do the AL East draft next week, so we'll have wrapped it up. So
okay.
We'll have the AL East draft. That'll be probably our last podcast of 2013. Because the next week is, I don't think we'll be doing one that next week. We'll be finishing up handbook and otherwise not working, hopefully. So thanks, everyone, for the download. We will talk to you again next week, and you can start prepping on who you think we're going to take in our AL East prospect draft. So long, everybody.